All right, so I'm calling this talk Integrating Insights. And this is in response to another question submitted to my, I have a Google form that just, it's open, there's links in the newsletter. So if you have any Dharma questions, any topics you want me to cover, you can submit them. And if you have done that recently, you'll know, like, I mean, yeah, you're almost guaranteed that I'm just going to talk about it the next Sunday. So you will get your Dharma questions answered. So this one was about integrating insights. As I said in the newsletter, so on the meditation seat and off, we may experience significant insights, realizations that shift our perceptions of ourselves and the world and help relieve suffering. And they may be sudden or gradual, major or minor. But we naturally want to be able to hold on to them in some way instead of just forgetting them or going back to our previous ways of thinking or being. But sometimes insights tend to slip away or fade with time. And our efforts to hold on to them sometimes seem to cause them to recede even further. So how do we integrate them into our lives and practice? So first, starting, of course, with the word insight. So I'll just read some definitions of insight to get our juices flowing. As a noun, it's an instance of apprehending the true nature of a thing, especially through intuitive understanding. Second is penetrating mental vision or discernment, faculty of seeing into inner character or underlying truth. And there's three psychological definitions. An understanding of relationships that sheds light on or helps solve a problem. The recognition of sources of emotional difficulty. An understanding of the motivational forces behind one's actions, thoughts, or behavior. So just to further explicate, apprehend is to grasp the meaning of, understand, especially intuitively, to perceive. So just to create a Buddhist definition of insight, an insight is an apprehension of something which then relieves suffering or increases wisdom, compassion, or skillfulness. So something which furthers us on our path. So we have those goals, right, of being more present in our lives, of relieving suffering, of becoming more open-hearted and compassionate and generous, of becoming more wise, becoming more skillful, more able to manifest compassion and wisdom in the world in a way that's effective. So any of those things, any kind of apprehension which results in moving along toward those things would be our Buddhist insight. Now, the look more into apprehension. So the insights, when we're talking about insight, we mean an experience. So this is experiential, but it includes the mind. It's not like it's only a physical experience and it excludes the mind, but it's not limited to the mind. And I think our minds start to, depending on your mind, it starts to spin about that, right? Like, well, if we don't apprehend it with our mind, then how are we apprehending it? Is it just with the body or does the mind shut off? How do we know if we don't know, if we're not using the mind, how do we know? But I mean, this is all like really irrelevant worry, right? How do you know whether it's warm or cool right now? How do you know what time of day it is? How do you know whether you are safe right now? How do you know what your relationship is to the rest of the people in this space, physical or virtual? There's all kinds of things that we know in this moment, which are not like just intellectual, they're not just physical, they're just, we just, it's just a whole being knowing. We don't divide mind and body, which is why a lot of times when we're translating Dogen, it's body hyphen mind, body mind. And sometimes insight comes with words to explain or describe it. For somebody who's very verbal like me, it forms a little narrative pretty quickly, but not necessarily always. So the person who submitted this question talked about having a very, in Zazen, having a very, I don't even know if she described it as physical, but it was a whole body experience that didn't necessarily just translate into a neat little narrative. So sometimes it's just very experiential and even mostly physical. But at least in the moment, no matter what, by definition, it causes a change in us. At least for that moment, our orientation to the world is different, it's changed. Our understanding of ourselves is different. Sometimes this is big, sometimes this is small, but some delusion is seen through, some new possibility opens up. Now, as discussed in the last Dharma talk, there are questions from the perspective of practice which do not tend to edification. There are many questions in the world which we cannot directly, personally apprehend. We wish we could, right? What is the solution to violence and war? You know, are there other beings in the universe? There's, what is the cure for cancer? Be nice if we could just, if we just got into a calm enough state, we could just apprehend the answers to these things. So there's many things we can't know. But the message of Buddhism is that we can apprehend everything we need to know in order to live a better life. So anything that is relevant to our own experience, our own skillfulness, our own understanding, we can know that, we can apprehend that directly. In order to relieve suffering, increase wisdom, compassion, and skillfulness. So insight may be small or major, sudden or gradual. They may involve a radical change in the way we see the world, or only a subtle shift in how we see one particular aspect of our lives. But generally speaking, there is at least one moment where we go, oh, or we go, ah. There's a moment of, the light bulb going off, that moment of comprehension, where we recognize the change in our understanding. So the original insight in Buddhism was, of course, the Buddha's. So, he sat down under the Bodhi tree after years and years of practice, and he decided to try this particular form of meditation. He sat all night, and by the time, when the morning star rose, he describes, when the mind was thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of defilement, pliant, malleable, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of the ending of mental fermentations. So mental fermentations are specifically sensuality, becoming, and ignorance, but all the things that keep sentient beings stuck in their pattern, their harmful patterns. I discerned, as it was actually present, this is stress, or dukkha. This is a translation that translates dukkha as stress. So as it was actually present, so the Buddha like was sitting there and he saw, not just, you know, I created a philosophy where he saw, this is stress. This is the origination of stress. This is the cessation of stress. This is the way leading to the cessation of stress. My heart, thus knowing, thus seeing, was released from the fermentation of sensuality, released from the fermentation of becoming, released from the fermentation of ignorance. With release, there was the knowledge released. I discerned that birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task done. So I'm not going to talk about what the Buddha realized there. If you're curious and you want to learn more, my Zen Studies podcast episode 9 goes into that. What did the Buddha realize? I just wanted to note his very substantial awe. So he had been searching for the resolution to this question for years and years and years. And then he went, ah, there it is, I get it. And after that, his life was radically altered, the way that he saw the world and the way that he practiced and the way that he recommended that others practice. So in some of my previous talks and podcast episodes, I've called insights, these smaller moments, I've called them enlightenments. Now, classically Buddhist enlightenment, you know, is sometimes that's what we call kensho, or seeing the true nature of the self, seeing the empty and boundless nature of self. But that's actually just one step toward enlightenment. Or it's a life-altering realization like the Buddha's, or it's the culmination of practice. I mean, we don't really talk about it a lot in the sense of emphasizing it as some kind of thing to strive for. But particularly because most of our practice, or maybe all of our practice, is experienced in enlightenments, smaller steps. Insights which make a difference, however small, and add up over time. So one of my examples, which I talked about I told the story of my spiritual journey on my podcast, was that asking what is the meaning of life was the wrong question. It'd been a question I'd been carrying, you know, since I could remember, since I was a child. And it all seemed quite pointless. I mean, yeah, pleasant sometimes, entertaining sometimes, but where is this all going? What is this all for? Especially, you know, why endure the bad stuff? It seemed very pointless. And then at one point in practice, I just, what if I walk down this hallway without that thought? And I had practiced long enough that I could do a little, you know, mental experiment like that. And I just, you know, while I was at work, and just walked down this hallway just without that thought. And I was like, oh, like, what? That thought is the problem. Like, that thought is a problem manufactured by my mind that has been causing me all this woe. And like, that's not even the whole point. And I really never again picked that the burden of that thought up again. I mean, I explored other things. It's not like, oh, now I know the meaning of life. I just recognize that I'm going about it the wrong way. I'm presupposing a whole bunch of stuff with that question, and I need to just drop it and be more open. But this was experiential. Now, if somebody had told me that the day before, somebody saying, you know, I mean, just searching, you know, always asking for a meaning, it's like you're missing the main point of life. It's not something that you just, that would not have made any difference, right? I would just be like, yeah. So this is an insight, is, you know, something we actually experience. So how do we hold on to our insights? And as I talk, I'm hoping that some people will be willing to share an insight that you have experienced, and then kind of how did that unfold over time? How did that stick with you or not stick with you? How did you try to get it to stick with you, and what failed and what worked? But basically, we don't want to forget what we've learned. We don't want to slip back into our old way of seeing or thinking or speaking or behaving. Over time, if you are involved in Buddhism or Zen long enough, you may pick up the understanding that we shouldn't hold on to insights. We should just let them go. I don't know how many of you have picked that up yet. Maybe you haven't. I certainly did. And this reflects the reality that a certain way of trying to hold on to them is ineffective and problematic. So we may want to, I'm sure this isn't an exhaustive list, but we may want to preserve the memory of the experience of insight. Not always, but sometimes it comes along with a certain sense of, excitement or openness or brightness or hope or, you know, wow or whatever. And we want to recall, you know, what we thought and saw and felt. Experience of release or relief or joy. We may want to preserve that sense of a significant shift in being, in perception, in the way we think of ourselves or relate to the world, an experience which may be empowering and hopeful, right? Oh, like change is possible. We may want to recreate the experience, the clarity of vision, the content of the insight itself, so we can be sure to carry with us what we have learned. So maybe you have a moment of, you know, it's bright and luminous, and you recognize you are not fundamentally separate from all that is. And so, you know, a lovely experience. And, you know, maybe you had it in meditation, or maybe you had it sitting on the shore of a lake or something, but, you know, forever after in meditation or on the shore of that lake, it's like, all right, go on. Ah, oh, like, I know it's true. I want to feel it again. So we could describe these efforts as trying to hold on to or to preserve the experience we had. The experience of insight. And naturally, we're doomed to fail at this because we can never recreate an experience. And the more special the experience, the less we'll be able to recreate it. And this is true of any kind of experience, of love or intimacy or joy or being moved by beauty, or, you know, the classic thing of, you know, the first time we experience a drug or some kind of far out experience and all the rush of that, but then we can never quite recreate that again. So when we try to hold on to the experience, This precious thing inevitably recedes in our memory. Although it may have seemed incredibly vivid and significant and life-altering at the time, we find the memory getting more and more fuzzy. It no longer evokes the same feelings. We may even start forgetting exactly what it was we realized. Or, when recalled, the realization doesn't seem all that remarkable. At least not as remarkable as it seemed at first. The experience starts to feel stale. And we may, not always, but sometimes we may feel regret or sadness, grief, disappointment, or pain at the loss of something that seemed to promise us greater clarity, peace, a better way of being, you know, an insight into like maybe a relationship. And we're like, oh, you know, from here on out, this is going to be better. And then maybe it doesn't quite pan out the way that we had hoped. So when we experience insight, it's very tricky. What now? If we try to hold on to the experience, we're doomed to fail. So maybe we do the good Zen thing and let it go. And to some of us, this has meant dismissing or pushing away the insight, not daring to appreciate it or contemplate it or celebrate it, because we'll just get caught in trying to hold on to it, and we don't want to do that if we want to be a good Zen student and not do that. But what can we do? We need to differentiate between seeking to integrate our insight from trying to hold on to the experience of it. The memory of the experience will inevitably fade, and we may feel some regret about this, and that's okay. Well, we're used to this in all other aspects of our lives. So we can't hold on to the experience, which includes a sense of newness, of something being remarkable, of our inevitably inflated hopes of what a difference this might make to our lives, perhaps of hope or joy or freedom, of clarity, a moment of great clarity. So those are aspects of the experience which we can't hold on to. But we want to hold on to what we learned. But hold on is probably not a good term, right? Because that implies like, I'm going to take it right here and I'm going to make sure that it doesn't change or go anywhere. So that's not a great term, but we don't want to forget. We want to continue the learning process. So I have 4 suggestions and then we can open it up. So I recommend small or large insights or enlightenments, that we should celebrate and appreciate them. They're always wonderful. And for as long as the memory lasts, let it arise and relish it and appreciate it and be grateful for it. And 2 is, but do that with open hands. Knowing the memory of the experience will fade, and also that the many ways to describe it, but this the contour and texture of what we have learned will also change. And just being prepared for this will help us be less confused and upset, I think, when this happens and when it changes, even if we still feel some sense of loss. And then 3 is to allow the insight to make changes in you. So this is not an active process, but it is not a passive process either. So this is not about the executive eye analyzing the insight, trying to get more out of it. You know, like what else can we squeeze out of this? Insight, or making a plan, you know, for how to change. Like, okay, now I Now we're going to do it like this, and I'm going to act like this, and blah, 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 and I'm going to investigate this. But nor is this about checking out or distracting ourselves. Sometimes, honestly, an insight is a little discombobulating or even a little bit disturbing or whatever. And there might be part of us that just wants to like push it aside. Or we just, I don't know, if we're not prioritizing practice in our lives, it would be very easy to have an insight and then just kind of our life to be so full of distraction and busyness and whatever that we just never really think about it again. So this relationship to an insight in the sense of not trying to grasp it with the executive eye, but also not trying to push it away, you know, it's just like when we're doing our zazen. When things arise, we're not trying to grab onto them and make more of them, but we're not trying to push anything away either. Just letting things be. But it requires a presence. This is the tricky, tricky thing about our kind of meditation, right? Which is like, has no meditative object, and we're just sitting there allowing things to arise and pass. And so we slip into, you know, the executive eye trying to do something while we're sitting there. But then we also can slip into just kind of a not really engaged in the process. We're just, I don't know, just daydreaming or resistant or whatever. And it's the sweet spot, you know, where we are. We're not trying to control it, but we're very present. So that's similarly what we want to do with our insights. I mean, you know, it's not like we have to constantly be like that, but at least in part, to be present with them, but not trying to have an agenda. And all aspects of our practice help us do this. So our zazen, our mindfulness throughout the day, but particularly our zazen. So it is, you know, very recommended, especially if you have insight that is of a more, what do you say, like a spiritual nature, something that we would describe in Buddhism. Then it is very strongly recommended that you do sit a fair amount of zazen afterwards. That is part of that process of just not because you're sitting there and thinking about it, but you're being present with it. And then the fourth thing is to trust the process and know you will never be the same after your insight. I think that's one of the more challenging things, is a sense of, because we lose that memory of the experience, because what we have learned may, after a while, not seem that remarkable, or it may just kind of seem to fade into the background or something, we are concerned that we've lost it, that we have forgotten it. And yet, one of my favorite sayings from my Dharma grandmother, Roshi Kennett, was, having seen a ghost, we can never again be someone who has not seen a ghost. So to some extent, we just have to, as long as we are doing the practice, right, of trying to be present for our lives, of trying to allow the insight to make a change in us, as long as we're doing that practice, we can trust that at some level we have been changed, at some level our relationship to the world has been changed, and then kind of stop worrying about it. Just know that it's become part of us. So I will leave it there. Any questions or comments? And like I said, if anyone If you do, you can think of an insight that you have had, in particular one that has been kind of precious to you. And then, you know, your story of how you related to that over time. Lovely to hear if you were willing. Jinryu.
Before we get into the discussion, because I'm very interested in this, but would you mind just running through the four things real quick?
Yeah. Celebrate and appreciate, but keep your hands open. That's number two. And I feel like that open-handed appreciation is, you know, a practice of gratitude would be very consistent with that. Just grateful that this happened without a sense of wanting to grasp it. And the third is allow the insight to make changes in you. And the fourth is trust the process. You will never be the same. Dave.
I can go. I'm reluctant to tell my story because I've told it like three times in the past 6 months.
But not so much about the
integration, So essentially last March, my practice had become intolerable because all I was doing day in, day out was just beating myself up. There was this voice in my head, you know, you're worthless, you're a failure, you're a bad person. That kind of just negative self-talk was just relentless. And so it became the focus of the term student thing that I was working on. And long story short, I was sitting in a car looking at a cherry tree, because the cherry blossoms were in bloom at the time. And the thought occurred to me, if I stop caring about that, who else cares? And like in an instant, it stopped happening. It was as if I was in a room with a loud motor running and the motor just turned off. Like that was just suddenly, that was gone, you know. I'm happy that I can get through the story without crying now, because I usually cry. But so that's me incorporating it. It's gotten to that point. How have I incorporated? I don't think I have. I mean, it was 9 months ago and I feel like the dust is still settling. That thing hasn't come back, but I'm starting to see other things. Now that that thing is gone, there are other sort of underlying things, and I don't know, and it's tough because that sense of you know, I'm not worthy, I'm not good, was kind of pushing me to the practice to begin with, and now that it's gone, I don't know what's left in this place. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a challenge. We'll see how it turns out. And I always describe it as an epiphany. I don't know why we don't use that word more often, but I like that word in English.
Thank you. Yeah, it does make me think, you know, and we could probably go quite into this, but now there are different kinds of enlightenments, epiphanies, insights, and it seems like certain ones where, like what I was talking about with the meaning of life question and what Davis was talking about, is like, when the insight is so much into one of your own pet delusions, like you, it's entirely of your creation, it's entirely in your head, and you see it for the bullshit it is. Like that is usually a very, it's just never the same after that. I mean, you just, you've seen through it. I mean, it's not all your problems are solved, other problems arise. But like that problem isn't there anymore. And that's a very kind of clean and simple kind of insight. But there's many other kinds of insights. I know that, you know, I've had not a single insight perhaps, but just a state of being that I have managed to get into during a long meditation retreat, for instance, of just being very, very open and in the moment, and feeling very like the separation between self and all things is very, very permeable. And then, I mean, that feels like an insight, and yet, you know, time and time again, then I've gone back into, you know, my life, my ordinary daily life, and in the necessity of just living ordinary life, that just becomes kind of a memory. It's a different kind of thing, you know, a way of being, perhaps insight into the authenticity and joy of a certain way of being, but one that you have not learned how to do or made a habit of in a different set of conditions. So that's a whole another kettle of fish in a way. But I suppose in a certain sense, you're still, that's still with you. You know, you still know that is possible, and that changes your orientation to the world. Karen, and then Leah.
So I had a life-changing realization because I have a son who has an addiction, and through my experience with him, I learned that, I mean, it's very clear to me now that I cannot change another person. I can't gently guide another person to live their life in a direction that I think would be better for them. I had known those. I mean, I had heard those thoughts before I even had before I knew my son had an addiction. But until I had like tried, you know, everything that I thought a loving mother would do to try to help him, and, you know, was not helping at all. I finally just had the, I guess I finally, out of desperation, just tried to step back and, you know, do nothing other than continue to love him and support him just like I would any of my other kids. But as far as like stepping in and physically doing things that I thought would keep him sober, you know, none of that works. And I've been able to apply the same concepts to other things in my life. And it's kind of, I don't know how many of you guys know the Serenity Prayer, but it's, let's see. It's to
be the serenity.
Yeah, the Serenity Prayer, which I think of all the time. Right now, I can't think of how it goes, but grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And even last night, and by the way, my son's doing really well, so I'm super grateful for that, of course. But I applied that last night because my 93-year-old mother has short-term memory issues right now. And for the good part of the year, she hasn't been taking her medications correctly or probably at all. And she recently, about a month ago, moved into assisted living and has been absolutely resistant, 100% resistant to any help with her medications. And she had some lab work done recently, and her levels are like dangerously high, and, you know, it's clear she's not handling her medications well. So anyway, about last Friday, she kind of came around to letting the facility dose her medications for her, and I talked to her several times a day, and I said, so, you know, did they bring you your medications? And this is Friday night, and she said, well, they did, but they didn't look right, so I refused to take them. Just like, you know. So anyway, so last night I was just laying in bed. Like, I woke up like at 1, and I just started ruminating about, she's just going to die because she's not taking her medications. She won't accept any help. Anyway, so I found myself just going right back to that serenity prayer of, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, there's nothing I can do about this. And the thing I can do is go talk to the staff, you know, the next day, today. And it just, it really helps me to apply that tool, you know, and I don't know if I'm doing all the things that you were saying, Damio, that I shouldn't do, like hanging on to it or whatever. But for me, it's been so helpful, even like at my workplace, you know, with my coworkers and with my kids and so many different aspects, just to kind of step out of people's lives and let them, you know, experience their own made joys or failures or whatever it is. And to, you know, in the case of my mother, you know when to step in and help her out. So anyway, that's been really a great insight for me that I don't plan to get rid of.
Yes, thank you for sharing. And I think yours is an example of another kind of insight, which is more of a, I don't know, like an operational kind of insight, right? Like it's a way that we function in the world. And a lot of times, this is another example perhaps of one where it's not that difficult to integrate an insight, because we just naturally want to avoid suffering. So when we recognize really clearly this thing leads me down a bad path and there's another option, like we're very, as long as it may take us a while to always kind of remember that in any given situation, but once we do, we're very naturally drawn to go down the path that causes less suffering. So it's like, you know, we picked up that object, we realized it was hot, we let it go, like we're not going to pick it up again. Thank you. Leah.
Thank you for all your stories. Oh my gosh, they're so good. This is the story that I tell, and it's like everybody knows it that I know. My family knows it, and my friends know it. So it's, I always go, stop me if you've heard this before. I had a epiphany, and I always use that word, David. You're right. It's a good one. When I was 11, I don't know, long time ago. And I was walking up the hill to my house. I was living in the mountains in the forest, a long way away from anything. And I had to take a bus and then catch a ride and then get let off and then walk the remaining mile and a half to my house. So, and I think that's good for a young person to be in that state, because you get a lot of thinking time to yourself. So I was 11 and I was walking up the road to my house, and I was worrying about homework because I was 11. And I just worried and worried and worried. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's so horrible that I have all this homework. And what happens if I don't do well, you know, and everything. And then I had a moment where I just went, okay, so then what? I was sort of having a conversation with myself in my head. I thought, well, you know, if I don't do well on homework, I don't do well in school, then I won't get good grades. Okay, well, then what? Well, if I don't get good grades, I won't get into a good college. Okay, well, then what? Well, then I won't get a good job, and I won't, you know, I don't know. It just kept like going down like the, and then what? And then I got to the end of it, and I said, well, if I, you know, if everything's contingent and all these things happening and they get to the end and they're still, and then what? It's like, why not just be happy now? Why not just be happy now? I'm depending on all these things to happen or for me to be happy and to be okay right now and not worry. Then it's like, why not just do that right now? And I was like, oh, okay. So I remember getting home, and because I was 11, completely forgetting about the epiphany, still worrying about homework for years. You know, I'd love to report that I was so enlightened at the time. Mm-hmm. It was great. And, you know, no, I didn't really stick with it, but I did remember it in the sense of I'm the person who, I love that example, like you've seen a ghost and now you're a person who's seen the ghost. It's like I'd gotten to that point where I sort of could recreate the conditions, you know, stand in the forest again and look up and look around and go, so, you know, that sort of, yeah. And it's almost like I can't explain it in words. It's just like a very experiential, as you describe. And the point that I walk away from with this is that I think 40 years later, the fact that I'm still remembering that day that I had that thought is, and even though I wasn't, because I was a kid, I wasn't in a place to, like you said, like sit with it. If I were an adult and I had a good way of sitting with it and processing it, I don't know, maybe, but you never know. These thoughts that you had years ago, they can come back up and you can remember them, and then their meaning changes over time and they can become more useful and important in your life. So,
thank you. Yeah, I think that's a great example, and reminds me too of the value of sharing your insights with Dharma friends or Dharma teachers if you think that they might have some significance, you know, within the realm of your practice. Because outside the realm of practice, I think just by chance, probably people have plenty of insights, but without a context for them, you know, if one of you comes and describes to me that, you know, you had this moment of a sense of like, of, you know, permeability and of just really not being separate from anything around you or something like that, I can be like, yes, that reflects reality. You had an insight into truth as we understand it communally, as opposed to you, if you had no context, you might be like, well, that was a weird experience. Just like, just this, you know, just this mind state that went by and yeah, it was kind of wacky, you know, but you wouldn't realize it actually had significance. It was actually a taste of the truth. So I think that's valuable too, is to recognize, like, and to get some confirmation that this is a piece of the truth. Yeah, Betty.
Thanks for this talk. So I haven't had any great epiphanies around insights, or maybe I have, and I'm so non-attached to them that I completely forgot. I don't know, maybe. But what I realized just today and this week is there's been a little shift in some of my feelings having to do with compassion and like moving away, not anger and fear, or maybe too strong words, moving from a place of anger and fear toward a place of compassion. And it's been a really subtle shift. And the awe moment is like, I'm feeling some other stuff, you know, I'm feeling a little different and recognizing that there's a shift. That's the aha moment. It's not really even an aha moment. It's more like, oh. So that's been really valuable. And it'll probably go away, like with when I get in the car and drive home, right? So anyway, but I think practice will help. I'm hoping that those things are happening because of practice. So I'm optimistic that they'll come back more and more frequently, and I'll learn.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, many of our changes are gradual. And I like that idea of it just, it might be an aha later of just, oh, I'm acting in this way and it's kind of nice.
Yeah, that's what
it's actually is nicer this way.
That feels good.
Oh. Yeah.
And that feeling of joy that whatever the feeling was that you talked about, the feeling that resonated with me was sort of a sense of joy somewhere in here, you know, very deep. Nice.
Thank you. All right. It's 12:15. One more, Brian.
I just wanted to endorse that sort of just stating the epiphany. So even if you don't have it and therefore don't have the problem of trying to hold on to it, you can sort of hold on to the anticipation of it in that way. And I think that's a, you know, kind of a worthwhile payoff for kind of the Dharma or living according to the precepts or whatever. So anyway, I just wanted to.
What do you mean exactly, Brian?
Well, you know, sometimes we think about this, we talk about, you know, what to do with the epiphany that you've had, right?
Yeah.
So I think the flip of that is also, what do you do, you know, what about just stating the epiphany you haven't had yet? And I think that was what I was hearing just now was resonating with me, which is like, yeah, okay, nothing's kind of knocked on the door and said, puh, I'm here. But instead, you know, you sort of keep at the practice, and you do have this kind of low level, like, yeah, it's better. I think I'm doing better. I think, you know, I'm seeing things differently and stuff. It's nothing, again, that's coming with trumpets and, you know, neon lights or anything, but it's just a day-to-day kind of thing. And it's, you know, maybe it's just stating, you know, some epiphany down the road, or maybe it's a, you know, like a calculus function, the summation of them is, you know, equals something. But anyway, it's just, but that, you know, what was said before kind of resonated in that way. Yeah. So
another phrase for them that my Dharma grandmother, Roshi Kennett, I believe, coined was, these are moments that make us dance. And sometimes they can be so subtle, you know, when you describe them to somebody else, they sound kind of dorky or like obvious or whatever. But I don't know, for me in particular, like Leah talking about that day, and like, it's like, it's really weird. Any of these insights that I've had over the course of my life, I have a visual snapshot of exactly where I was. It's just kind of it's like I could put put together a little photo album of my insights. It's strange. Anyway, thank you all for being here. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. Mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prashna Paramita.